This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This is Game of Thrones 2 Electric Bookaloo, Midpoint Book Reflection, Another Lookaloo. I'm your host, Anthony. As the title suggests, this week we are departing from our usual format. Because we are at the exact midpoint of a Game of Thrones, I thought we'd take an opportunity to step back, widen the scope, a lot of the meta with friend of the podcast, Carl Nellis. Carl, you may remember from the previous visit, is in books, he's in podcasting, he's also got a graduate degree in medievalism, and he's one of my favorite people to talk to about Game of Thrones. This week we talk a lot about the modern American imagination and the myth of a medieval Europe that exists in America about the time that Martin is writing this work. And we talk about, you know, whether Martin is a product of this mythic imagination or if he intends to subvert it. And then Aaron, Bo Smang Aaron, is back to talk about his project related to Foundation. That'll be an Aaron and Jim joint covering Apple TV's adaptation of Asimov's epic reimagination of the fall of the Roman Empire set in galactic scope. So big scopes all around. I hope everyone's watching along with Foundation and following with the Foundation coverage on Bald Move. Without further ado, here is Carl Z. Nellis. Carl, people that are interested in your podcast library, where can they find these?
Well, the show that I work on the most is called Unobscured. And so you can find it in podcast players everywhere.
So tell me, what project are you working on with Unobscured right now?
Yeah, so this year we've been researching, writing, talking with historians, and we've pulled together a documentary on Rasputin.
Oh, nice.
Grigori Rasputin and his role in the lives of the Romanovs as a religious teacher, as a political force, and then especially as a mythic presence, as all this propaganda was spun up against him, and the role that all of that played in the end of the Romanov dynasty, the Russian Empire, the First World War.
That sounds fascinating.
So, yeah, I do the research and writing. Aaron Mankey is the host, and you'll hear from a lot of great historians on
nice.
It, too. Yeah.
So listeners that are interested in that can search for Unobscured, something along those lines.
Unobscured podcast.
Wonderful. Carl, today, as you know, we will be doing a mid-book reflection. I love having these big picture sort of wide scope conversations.
Yeah.
And every now and again, I get a chance to do it in this chapter by chapter review. But every now and again, I want to set aside a little bit of space just to talk about the big picture stuff.
I love it too. And it gets me back into my literary analysis mode. And I'm not always, you know, in that mode these days, but I love being there. It's home for me. So
here's what I'd like to do. I've tried my hand at creating a synopsis for the entire first half of the book. So clearly this is going to be very broad strokes, but I'm going to go ahead and read this. Okay. Ned has reluctantly become King Robert's second in command while also investigating Robert's many infidelities in the hope to discover the cause of John Arryn's death. Robert is worried about a new Targaryen pretender, which creates a wedge between he and Ned. Ned resigns in protest, leaving him open to Jaime's attack. Jaime has done his best to keep his relationship with Cersei a secret, including pushing Bran from a tower window. Otherwise, he seeks retribution against Ned because Catelyn has captured Tyrion. Catelyn has captured Tyrion because she believes that he's conspired to murder her son and perhaps Jon Arryn too. Tyrion remains a prisoner at the Eyrie because of this, but has managed to make a few friends along the way, including Jon Snow and Bronn. Jon Snow is adjusting to a hard life at the Wall as an acolyte of the Night's Watch. Arya and Sansa were both enjoying their new lives at King's Landing and resist the idea of returning to Winterfell. Sansa wants to marry Joffrey as promised. Arya is thriving under her new dancing master. Dany is finding her voice, power, and vision as the new Khaleesi of Khal Drogo's nomadic tribe. She has cast aside her brother's power and hopes to place her son on the Iron Throne. Finally, Littlefinger, Varys, Illyrio, and Jorah continue to scheme in the shadows. All the while, something cold and monstrous lives and looms beyond the Wall.
Mm.
That is my mid-book Relookaloo synopsis, Carl. I was worried, you know, that there are some really key characters that have not even been mentioned in the synopsis. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, I mentioned Zero about Theon. I didn't really mention Rob. Their stories mm-hmm. kind of haven't begun yet in the sense of
right.
being important to the
even
plot.
Even so, listening to you layer on attempts to try right. to include everyone who you did include, sure. the thing that it emphasizes for me is that even in book one, the breadth of the story, the scope, mm-hmm. right? The scale, mm-hmm. the number of people whose stories we're getting in this book, that this is an attempt to crowd, you know, like I think about opening the pages and having all these voices shout up. It's just such a, I recently read a fantasy novel that I really liked that was fairly small. And it basically covered the lives of four people from the beginning to right. the end of the book. This is not that kind of book.
No, it's not. And on top of that, there's at least two levels of storytelling happening. Martin has taken upon himself to start to tell the stories of several different point of view characters.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a half a dozen characters that he's really sort of creating a backstory for. He wants to explore their settings, explore what motivates them, and how they relate to these plots that he's putting in motion. In addition to that, he's also trying to tell us the history of Westeros, or at least mm-hmm. the parts of that history that will end up repeating themselves in the lives of these characters, or as sort of an element of world building, trying to tell us enough about the world and the history of the world to make these particular characters authentic in relationship to that world.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel like, I mean, at this point, if we just go by what this book has told us, you know, we have some notion of like Targaryen dynasties. We have some yes. notion about Robert's Rebellion. We have some notion about sort of the history of the Night's Watch, but we don't know yes. a whole lot. I mean, we know a whole lot more about why Sansa wants to be queen than we know about sort of the history of the White Walkers.
Yeah. We know a few other things too. We know a little bit about great houses and bannermen.
Right.
And sure. and systems right. of vassalage and patronage, right?
Sure. And how much of that is, okay, so that's a good point. How much of that is Martin drawing on our modern imagination of sort of an idealized medieval world?
That's actually something I really wanted to talk a lot about because...
Right, good. Me too.
Because as I've been thinking about what does this book give us, you know, kind of the big picture reflections that we wanted to get into, I was thinking about history. And the way that some people talk about Game of Thrones, I had a friend before I started to read it who introduced it to me. He said, finally, like fantasy has grown up or something like
sure,
that.
Sure, sure, sure.
You know,
yeah.
And now we're reading a book that tells us what it was really like back then.
Which is sort of this lie that we're happy to acquiesce to, or at least we're suspending disbelief, right?
Yes, yes. And the two pieces of that, that he knows he's talking about fantasy, but he places fantasy at a real point in time.
Sure.
You know, I was like, whoa, like it was a mind bender.
Well, that's the power of our imagination, right? And really that was sort of the world that was passed on in oral history, you know, that dragons and unicorns are real. Like my cousin saw them. My cousin two villages over actually saw one once. That's all part of the world that sort of that oral history is going to put forth to us.
And to your point, I was thinking about fantasy and even our idea that like fantasies are childish, still kind of reflecting on those things that my friend said when he was so excited about this fantasy series that he was introducing me to. And we have this idea about fantasy being juvenile, and I was thinking about the Victorian fantasists, and especially considering Martin as an American writer, dealing with medieval stories. I go back to Howard Pyle, who was an American painter, but also a writer of adventure stories for kids. He did Robin Hood that was extremely popular. He wrote many Arthurian legends into American English in the late 1800s and early 1900s that were extremely popular. He wrote a book called Men of Iron. He wrote a book called Otto of the Silver Hand. And I read all of these as a kid. This was like the Robin Hood that I read. Mm-hmm. This was the Arthur that I read, even though it was written 100 years before me, you know, late 1800s. But there was a period of time where there were all these Victorian era attempts to reclaim the medieval for modern purposes. And when I read Martin, I see him responding. You know, I went on to study medieval literature and to spend some time as a medievalist among medievalists in the academy. And when I read Martin, I see him responding more to Victorian medievalism than to the medieval itself in many, many cases. And I even think about your recent conversation with Ken Monshine, where you were talking about weapons. You know, and he says the names for weapons that Martin uses and the way he writes about medieval weapons sounds more like an antiquarian than a medievalist. Than a medieval person.
Or at least he pushes them to get together. Like he pushes a lot of ideas that would never have existed or things that would have never existed at the same time.
Yes.
He kind of pushes them into this make-believe world of his to maybe to give it a little bit more texture, I would imagine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was one of the things that when I started studying medieval history was mind expanding. Was realizing that what we popularly say is medieval, the Middle Ages, spans, well, the globe over the course of 1,000 years, you know, from 500 to 1500.
Right.
And we say, oh, that's
exists
the medieval.
In different pockets of varying cultures, you know, even in the same time period, you know, it's not going to be the same in Spain as it is in Scotland. That's just going to be different.
Yes. Well, and I was thinking about those Victorian medievalists, and we're talking the period of the British Empire. You know, we're talking about British Mandate Palestine, Orientalism, driving imperial expansion. We're talking about in America, Jim Crow era. And these are in many ways fantasies of empire and merging incredible diversity across a long time frame into some kind of homogenous thing that we can, when I say we, I mean those Victorian fantasists, claim as a precedent for our current cultural political project.
This is crucially important. I'm really happy we're getting here because I know you've done a lot of work on this topic. Could you explain to me, you threw me off a little bit when you included Jim Crow into the conversation.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain to me how that relates to the medieval Europe we've been talking about?
Sure. Well, because when I'm thinking about the American context and when and why certain Americans like Howard Pyle or going back to Thomas Jefferson, who loved Old English stuff, there were American medievalists. There were scholars who had a cultural project of trying to justify what they were doing in the Jim Crow era. You know, they were trying to build cultural support for white supremacy you know, some of it was backfill. They already had their way of thinking about who was important and who was not. But they wanted to have a lot of stories to tell about why they were important as powerful, rich, white Americans.
From this idealized golden age of white culture before it had been tainted or something like that. In other words, creating a history that never existed for the purpose of vision casting in the present.
Yes, and when I call their work fantasies of empire, I think they were doing something very similar to what Martin is doing, where, you know, the kind of conversations that you have been able to have with some amazing historians on this show about Martin, like, which pieces of medieval history did he pick up? Where does this come from? Where does that come from?
Mm-hmm.
All the conversations you've had with Jana Matthews have been really fun, answering questions that people have about what's really medieval here. That was the same kind of thing that medievalists were doing when they were pulling together the discipline even of medieval studies. And they were doing some of this flattening and homogenizing, saying, mm-hmm. we can talk about something that is the medieval, that is distinct, and ignore the scope, ignore most of the world. You know, just look at Europe. Just look at the people in Europe that we want to claim as our precedent. And I even think about a particular case where when I say the Jim Crow era, I'm not just talking about the South, because I did some work on a guy in Boston named Eben Norton Horsford. His family was German immigrants, and he wanted to get in with Boston High Society. He studied chemistry in Germany, came back and was the chair of chemistry at Harvard, but that didn't give him much social power.
And what, he still wasn't at what point did he live?
This is late 1800s.
Okay.
He made his money selling the leavening agent for hardtack to the Union Army. So this is a war contract, gets him a lot of money. War contracts then, as now, were very lucrative. And he pours his money into the cultural projects of the people he wanted to get in with. But they had this idea that that Vikings had settled Boston. And they really wanted to push it. And he said, you have this project, but these families didn't have this much money at this point, late 1800s, 1870s, 1880s. So he funded all their projects in order to get in with Boston High Society. But their point in doing this was to say, Boston is white Northern European. Our precedent is the Vikings. That's our point of origin. And they were specifically, some of the racial anxieties that were being expressed in that claim were about pushing back on this growing Irish and Italian identity. Southern European, you know, Catholic, Mediterranean. They were publishing all these books. Sometimes they were not subtle. One of the books they published was called America Not Discovered by Columbus.
Right. With impetus from the Spanish, Columbus the Italian could not get credit for establishing white America. Something like
right.
that.
Right. Right. Yes. So you see in this period across American life, white, educated, wealthy people looking for a precedent for them that they could claim as unique.
Right.
The nation builders of the Jim Crow era in America wanted to reclaim as the point of origin. But what they were doing, like Martin, was picking and choosing from the medieval past to build a kind of bleached white fantasy.
Right.
And that was what became their point of origin.
Yeah, that's, you know, you and I both have some experience in religious history.
Mm-hmm.
And the myth of beginnings is such an important political tool. And what I hear you saying is that in many ways, the origin story for white America was created hodgepodge out of a very selective gleaning of this medieval white Europe or something like that, or the imagination of a medieval white Europe.
Yeah, and the people, it wasn't like this was everyone doing this, right? But there were certain groups and communities of people who had that project. And there's a medievalist named Matthew Vernon who's written on what black communities were doing with a medieval past across a similar period. Really interesting. But the money and the reach of these white, especially scholars who were in universities, who were then communicating with people in positions of cultural influence outside the university at the time, the kinds of things they published meant that 100 years later, I was still reading Howard Pyle's books.
So bringing this to Martin, I wonder if we should imagine, I suppose, that Martin is both a product of that mythic imagination, but also sort of a postmodern critic of that imagination as well.
Yes.
I'm just thinking about sort of the ethnic representation in the story, for instance.
Yeah, right.
You know, how much is he merging ancient history and medieval history and, you know, American history into this War of the Roses retelling? I think he is consciously critiquing, and you're saying maybe he's consciously critiquing the Victorian era as well.
Yes, I think so. I mean, some of your other guests, medievalists, have talked about the kind of romantic versus gothic, or like the technicolor versus grimdark way of thinking about the Middle Ages. And Victorians were really doing that work of either romanticizing, especially romanticizing the Middle Ages. And many commentators on Martin have looked at the ways that he is subverting the romantic version. And we can talk more about today. You mentioned maybe we'll get into chivalry. And some of the really romanticized ways of looking at the Middle Ages and stories about the Middle Ages, those come to us through those kind of Victorian era, Jim Crow era medievalists and writers and popularizers. And so, yeah, I do see a lot of what Martin is doing, responding and often subverting, pushing back on, you know, pulling apart those fantasies of empire that were sanitized and that were valorized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chivalry thing is interesting to me. So after my conversation with Ken, I was asking him about knighthood and, you know, and all of its variations and whatnot.
Mm.
And he sent me this essay that he had written, and it was really fascinating. One of the things he said in the essay was that idealization of the knight, or, you know, in the knighthood, we think, you know, has these three elements of, it has this religious element, it has this sort of warrior, professional warrior element, but it also has this sort of social elite courtesy element to knighthood. But that these noblemen were doing is they were trying to create the ideal back then. In fact, even though it's an idealized past, it was an idealized past that they tried to invent and they tried to push forward because it was propaganda. They wanted there to be a system whereby the nobility looked noble. And one thing that he said that I thought was really interesting is that he said not every knight was a nobleman.
Yes.
But every nobleman wanted everyone else to think he was a knight.
Right.
So, in other words, it was propaganda that got pushed forward. And because there was no one to really subvert, I mean, I shouldn't say no one. There were critics of chivalry back then. But the dominant narrative was that the ruling class is a chivalrous group, a noble group. And so the propaganda became sort of the foundation for this mythology that, you know, for several centuries afterwards was just kind of swallowed whole.
So that's
to me, that's fascinating because it maybe doesn't tell us about how the world really was, but it does tell us about sort of the highest aspirations of the nobility of that world.
Yeah. Yeah. And I was thinking about chivalry in relation to Game of Thrones through a couple of texts. There's a scholar named Carol Parrish Jameson who published a book in 2018 called Chivalry in Westeros, The Knightly Code of A Song of Ice and Fire.
Hmm.
And she does a great job going back and looking at the development of chivalry across what we might call that whole medieval period, looks at regional variations, looks at where and when something like skill in the field of battle, you know, prowess was the mark of a knight relative to franchise or, you know, noble birth and noble bearing, and looks at it in relation to courtesy, you know. So she gives you this whole history of the development of this chivalry propaganda in the Middle Ages. And then she looks at which pieces of that, you know, it's like it's a stream and things are flowing by over that 1,000 years.
Right.
That we call the Middle Ages, and which pieces of it Martin picks as they flow by, you know, goes, we'll go to the 700s in France over here for that thing. And we'll go to 1300s England over here for that thing. And here's where, you know, heroic virtues get developed really into chivalry. So we'll take a little of that and use that in Westeros. So I found it a really fascinating study. Looking at and the interaction between a fantasist, you know, alive today, writing today, and how he was able to make use of and wanted to interact with, especially Arthurian stuff. She does a lot with Malory's Morte d'Arthur that is really fascinating. But that comes very late. The thing about Morte d'Arthur is it's reflecting back on centuries and kind of is itself a work of synthesis, thinking about knighthood, pulling together the pieces of that propaganda of what is a knight and chivalry and nobility.
Right. So certainly Martin is a critic of the mythology that we're talking about, and chivalry being a part of that world building, right?
Mm-hmm.
But to what extent is he a product of it? You know, he's writing in the mid-90s.
Yes.
And there's been a massive amount of work on the medieval world since then, right? So he cannot be the beneficiary of scholarship between now and then. So then the question is, let's say he was sort of a student of medieval history, but he's writing now. How would the story look different?
Yeah. There's a scholar named Kavita Mudden Finn who's written a lot on that point, especially relative to the lives of women in the Middle Ages, queens, peasants, nobility, but especially to female friendships. And she's written on Martin and said he doesn't have a lot to say about female friendships. There aren't too many groups of women or strong bonds between women at the center of the story. Mm-hmm. There's a lot about male friendships, and there's a lot about women in relation to men. There are
right.
some family relationships.
Does this, the first half of this book pass the Bechdel test?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, it'd be curious to find out because we have relationships like between Kat and Lysa, but they're usually talking about men, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
So famously, the Bechdel test would have to be, do you have a named female character who has a conversation with another named female character and that their conversation isn't about a man?
Right. Yeah. And Kavita Mudden Finn, in her writing, says, you know, one of the things she looks at is all this amazing evidence of women's lives across time, across the Middle Ages. And a lot of that scholarship that's turned its attention there has been since Martin started writing. You know, so like you
right.
say,
sure.
not the kind of history of the Middle Ages that was being published in the 60s, 70s, 80s that he then drew on mm-hmm. when he started writing. So there are, to your point, really missing pieces. So when you said that, the first thing that came to mind was Finn and Mudden Finn and her work, because she asked some of those same questions looking at, well, here's where some attention has gone from the scholarship since the 90s and early 2000s that has really helped us to see what we might call a real medieval world with more detail. And a lot of that is missing because Martin's talked about the fact that he did try to draw on history and scholarship. And, you know, he pulled from the books by Joseph and Francis Guise. On, you know, life in a medieval village, life in a medieval castle, but they were publishing in the 60s, 70s, 80s.
Yeah. Sure, yeah. I wanted to ask you about, are there certain world-building parts of this story that interest you especially relative to sort of maybe a few of your favorite characters or something like that?
Yeah, for me, it's animals and animal bodies. This comes from some work I did in the way that animals and humans lived together in the Middle Ages. I think about, in all kinds of contexts, but I'll start with the military. We're thinking about how expensive heavy cavalry is to run out, you know, to outfit. And I was thinking today, you know, today it's like, who can buy a helicopter?
Sure. Yeah, right.
You know? So, but a lot of what, looking back, provided the power, you know, in the days before the internal combustion engine or, you know, let alone nuclear power. We're looking at a lot of muscle power, animal power, horsepower, you know. And in the study I did on medieval animals, I was looking at a lot of, you know, kind of symbolism and things like that. But the material culture of the Middle Ages was, you know, it was metal, wood, and stone, but it was fur and bone and sinew.
Sure.
And at the same time, it was also not just turning animals into raw materials, but it was also human and animal life lived together. You know, pest control in your granary was cats, you know. And there's a lot in Martin on horses. And of course, the dire wolves are so fascinating. And you have
and
the
ravens,
the dragons.
I mean, that's your postal service,
yes.
Right?
right. Especially, yeah, to take that kind of fantasy element of like, merging the raven magically with the homing pigeon. It's so fun.
We haven't seen a lot of this part in Martin, but there were certain, you know, leeches and maggots were used in healthcare.
Yes. I remember
be an element of sort of the synchronicity between animal life and human life.
Yes. Well, and I love medieval bestiaries. So I remember reading Bodley MS 764. It's called, you know, such a compelling title in the classification system. But it's a great medieval bestiary. The illustrations are gorgeous. Uh-huh. But in the article on puppies, the line is, the tongues of puppies, see if I can remember this exactly. I probably can't, but are very good for wounds of the intestines.
Oh, gosh.
And I was like, whoa. Now, what I hope they meant was that puppies should lick the wounds.
I think that's probably what it means, but it could actually mean something else.
I know. Nope. No other possibilities. It's that the puppy comes and it licks you and it's nice.
Well, that would be better to me than cutting out the tongues of the puppy and using it in some sort of
yes,
elixir.
Yeah. But right, the way that medieval folks wrote about animals is fascinating. And they're drawing from ancient texts. They're drawing from whatever the guy down the street knows.
Right.
You know, the interesting compilation of religious knowledge, local knowledge, ancient knowledge to a limited degree that's all compiled often then with incredible illustrations is just so inspiring to me.
Right. Okay. So, all right. So let's bring this to Martin's world. So certainly Martin has a lot of, you know, crucial animal. Oh, not just, I mean, a lot of zoological themes.
Yes.
And sort of the blurring the lines between humans and animals in his work, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And warging, right? I mean, like you're saying, that's one of those huge questions about animalizing humans and humanizing animals, where you see that movement going back and forth. And you've already talked before about Hodor and that case where Bran wargs into Hodor in the show.
Right.
And what are the ethics of that? And is it kind of animalizing Hodor, dehumanizing him in some way?
Sure, yeah. Or there's a certain sense in which the warg and his direwolf have this symbiotic relationship. And you get the sense like, this is just sort of this psychic connection. But it's actually more than that. It's that the human imposes the will and mind onto the beast and pushes the beast's will and mind to the background.
Mm-hmm. And collects some surveillance data from
right.
the eyes and nose and ears.
That's
of the
fascinating.
Animal.
I hadn't even thought about that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think what other animals are in. I mean, that stuff, ravens, horses, dragons. I mean, the Dothrakian horses and like,
sure, the Dothraki
there's so many
culture.
Ways to
that's,
push
that
it.
Is,
yeah.
I mean, horses is everything for them. I mean, the horse yeah. meat, all of their mythology is built around horse culture. I mean, it's crucial for them. But then on top of that, you kind of see just a hint of that in some of the house sigils, you know?
Yes. I mean, I love the Mormonts. I wish we actually had more bears in the story.
Sure. Well, so did the showrunners. They wanted a zombie bear.
Yes. I love what animals get into Martin's world and what he does with them. And if I was going to do any writing on Martin, I think that's the track I would follow was taking, you know, what we might call like an animal studies approach.
Right.
To
yeah.
What's going on?
No,
in
that's
Game
an
of
interesting
Thrones.
One thing that I was thinking about in terms of how this book is a product of the world in which Martin grew up in is the amount to which this story, this plot, and these characters are driven by the problem of sex and taboo.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So, for instance, what Bran sees through the tower window, that's driving the plot.
Right.
And that kind of, the consequences of seeing that taboo in action creates a problem for his character, because now he's paralyzed. Or think about Jon Snow's, his entire life is overshadowed by the problem of Ned's supposed infidelity. Being a quote-unquote bastard in this culture, it's a category designed to create room for the fact of infidelity, however they wanted to define it. And Jon has this problem. Now, of course, we know now that it's not Ned's infidelity. This is a Lyanna Rhaegar problem. But Jon's entire life is under this shadow, this sexual taboo being, I don't know, normalized, I suppose.
Mm-hmm.
Or we think about Daenerys lives her first part of her life thinking she's going to marry her brother. So there's Martin dealing with a sexual taboo there. And her pregnancy also drives the plot. And then, of course, the bulk of Ned's plot has to do with figuring out why Robert's sex life got Jon Arryn killed.
Right. He's connecting the dots between all the bastards. Yeah.
Right. And of course, at this point in the story, we don't know yet Tyrion's sort of origin story with Tysha, but we know that he gets into big trouble for marrying below his station.
Right.
And in all of these ways, it's like sex and taboo related to sex is really driving a lot of this plot. And I wonder if this is sort of like, oh, this is an author that grew up in the wake of the sexual revolution.
Well, and this is where I want to just go back and say, this is not the kind of story we would get from a Victorian romantic medievalist.
Sure.
I think you're right, though. I agree that, I mean, it's not even that Martin grew up after the sexual revolution, right? I mean, he was born in 48. So he was an adult during the sexual revolution, right? He lived it. He lived the debates and the arguments, you know, and observed them happening, and the kind of cultural reckoning with taboo and patriarchy that and the backlash against those.
Well, on top
that
of that
reckoning,
you know, being, we don't want to sort of rely too much on, you know, the psychology of the author here. But it is interesting to me that Martin's backstory is very much Catholic. So there's a certain amount, you can imagine a certain amount of Catholic anxiety in the backdrop, even if, you know, the sexual revolution is being entirely embraced by, you know, Martin's sort of love of counterculture and Grateful Dead shows and whatnot.
yes.
You know, there's still that Catholic background, that there's that Catholic guilt back there trying to contend with these taboos.
Yeah. And so much of the sexual taboo, sexual violence is heteronormative, you know, or even the sex that's written approvingly by Martin.
Yeah.
So much of it is hung up on those issues and questions within a very confined heteronormative framework. Right.
Sure. No, Jana Matthews was probably the first to point out that even though HBO is sort of known for, you know, pushing the limits of sexuality on the screen, Game of Thrones was always very limited in the kind of sex it would show.
Yes, yes.
You know, it was always sort of younger, attractive bodies engaging in some sort of heteronormative activity until, you know, a little bit later, we see a little something different. But even so, it's like anything explicit is going to look a little bit like pornography.
I'm even thinking about the difference between the book and the show with Renly and Loras, where the show brings Renly and Loras' relationship to the screen. You
right.
know? And,
it's so and, sort of more of it's rumored in the book, right?
Right. Right. If you put the pieces together.
Yeah, if you put the pieces together. Yeah. It's rumored in the book. But then, you know, it shows them in very intimate situations.
Yes.
But not in the same way it's showing, like, Littlefinger's brothel. I mean, it's not softcore porn kind of stuff. And I think what Jana's point was is that there was an intentional effort in that first season to sort of capture the young male gaze, in other words.
Yeah. Yes. I think the male gaze directs both the show and the book.
Sure. I guess you're right in that way. For some reason, in my mind's eye, and I could be corrected on this, in my mind, the show is making explicit many scenes that are not as explicit in Martin's writing.
Mm-hmm.
Am I wrong?
Well, I guess my question would be, is that a virtue?
No. It's gross. Like, I think several times I've talked with Steve on this podcast about how brothels are gross and on several levels. But I've never appreciated the whole sex position element of the HBO adaptation.
Right. And I'm thinking in particular about how much a heteronormative male gaze does control the narrative, even in the book. And maybe we escape that a little bit, like in the case of actually getting Renly and Loras on screen in some ways. But not to praise either of them particularly, either the book or the show. But thinking about those questions, as you said, about like what are the questions about sex, power, you know, and sexual relationships that intrigue Martin and that he keeps coming back to.
Well,
they are
for
questions
Martin,
in a limited set.
I think
set.
A lot of this has to do, well, taboo is one of them for sure.
Yeah.
Because incest is such a huge part of this story. But I can only speak as sort of an expert on various ancient cultures. But
right,
the problem of progeny is huge, you know, sort of Egyptian politics or, you know, all the way up to sort of medieval Christian conversations about these things. The problem of progeny is so paramount because it ties up the sort of the value of the woman in the culture to her progeny. Bloodlines, succession, property transfer, you know, all of these sort of sexual rules that were developed in the ancient world had a lot to do with progeny, the problem of progeny, knowing which kid belongs to which set of parents. It's just absolutely crucial for the culture to function. So, you know, so you've got rules that are born out of that anxiety about the ability to produce not just progeny, but the right kind of progeny and the right person producing the right kind of progeny. And I see that in Martin's story for sure. You know, this whole business about bastards and, you know, whether Tyrion should inherit Casterly Rock or Robert's issue with Dany now that she's pregnant. That these are all problems of progeny.
Yeah. And this comes to me to one of the things you said we might talk about, which is kind of order and chaos in Martin's world and in book one. And there's a lot of chaos right on the surface that's easy to point at and say, well, that's chaos. So but I started thinking about, well, what are the forces of order? What actually are the forces of order in Martin's world at this time when, you know, the story is like, we're looking at a period of chaos here. But some of those forces of order are something like trying to follow the line of progeny with families. And these sexual mores that Martin is writing about, that's one of the forces of order. Like you just said, the society falls apart if you can't track which kid
right.
goes to which
yeah.
father.
Yeah, for instance, Ned's got this book at this point in the story, and he's poring over this book, and it's a really ridiculous book, if you think about it. It's like it's not a page-turner. It's just listing the succession of kings and their progeny. It's just a big list, right? That's just one example of an attempt to push out the chaos and hem in the order, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Kinship ties in Martin's world create kind of the order in which everyone lives, and those ties need to be reliable. They need to, you know, people need to be able to rely on them to hold the weight of their lives and of their conflicts and ambitions and its kinship ties that are the basis of the house system, but that really, you know, create the boundaries and borders between people that create antagonisms, but that also are expected to keep people together.
Yeah, like the ancient connection between the Starks and the Karstarks, right?
Right.
There's
exactly.
a reason why it's important for those families to remember their kinship, even if it's hundreds of years in the past.
Yeah, there's also the importance of making new kinship ties. You know, marriages, weddings
right.
in Martin are such key events, often because, you know, at two significant weddings in this story, things do not go as planned by some. Or there are some who take the reliance on kinship ties and the trust that comes with building new kinship ties to destroy the people who come in trusting, right?
Well, on top of that, it's interesting. Like, even someone like, right, so we look at someone like Joffrey, who, to his mind, he is both Baratheon and Lannister.
Mm-hmm.
So much so that he wants both sigils sewn on his coat of arms.
Right.
And so, you know, you see these ancient coats of arms and, you know, there's a lot of dividing lines and different symbols on depending on what's important to remember about one's, you know, family history. But even the sort of the psychological sense of where Catelyn is at the core of her being, she is a Tully.
Yeah. Yeah.
And yet she's, you know, she's doing the most out of anyone, I think, to try to advance the Stark cause in the political South in ways that Ned probably couldn't figure out or something like that. So she's
yeah.
the core of her identity is Tully, and yet she is, you know, 100% Stark at the same time. You know, it's like these family ties, they're so complicated, and someone like Catelyn just sort of reminds us how complicated they are.
In what you just said about Joffrey picking out what's important to remember,
mm-hmm.
and Catelyn reminding us of important things, I wonder if you could tell us more about me, everyone listening. I mean, I know that you have done a lot of work in what's called social memory. And I wonder.
Yeah, I've kind of avoided talking about my day job so far in this podcast.
But I know that some of your day job has to do with social memory.
Yeah.
And I wonder what that gives you. What do you bring to fiction?
Mm-hmm.
As someone who works on social memory.
When you brought this up in the email, I was thinking, you know, it's so funny that I'm so into fiction, and yet for some reason, my social memory apparatus usually only plays with history in that way. But there's no reason mm-hmm. why. There's no reason for the division. It's just that I like to, you know, keep my life compartmentalized or something. But you're right. So I guess if there's one sort of thing that I would be known for in the scholarly world is my work on something called social memory. A very succinct way to describe what social memory is. It's really got three things attached to it. One is that every individual memory is connected to some kind of social network. So your memories aren't necessarily your own. Some of your memories are your family memories. And some of your memories you got from your society. And these are, you know, bordering on collective memory, which of course relates to history. And we'd already mm-hmm. talked a little bit about how those can be distorted in, like, for instance, the myth of a lily white Europe or something like that.
Right.
The other thing about social memory is that it's the acknowledgement that memory is active. It's not passive, or it's fluid and not static. In other words, you're always reinventing your memories as you go. It's mm-hmm. not like you've got this vault and you've got this pristine memory that's sort of, you can just activate pristine memory. You know, your memories are always changing. They're always in service to the present. Not to say that you can't rely on your memory most of the time. It's just that your memory is always being refracted through the stained glass of your contemporary experience. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing about social memory that's crucially important is that when groups remember the past, the act of commemoration will often tell you more about their present than it does tell you about the object of the commemoration.
Mm-hmm.
So, for instance, if I put up a statue of General Lee in the late 1960s, am I doing it to commemorate Lee, or am I doing it as a backlash to the civil rights movement?
Right.
And how much do I even know about my motives? You know, is this conscious? Is this a conscious effort? Or, you know, in other words, why is the memory of Lee important to my culture at this particular point in history? Or right now I'm watching this documentary on Muhammad Ali. Mm-hmm. So then the question is, why is Muhammad Ali an important political figure in 2021? Those are the kinds of things that I'm curious about in relation to what religious people think that they're doing when they commemorate things.
Mm-hmm.
I honestly, when I'm looking at Martin, there's a certain amount of this that makes me think, of course, this is a novel written in the mid-90s, and so it's going to betray some of the world in which Martin's writing about in the mid-90s. Maybe some of his views on war are informed by this common sentiment about the horrors of Vietnam or something like that.
Yeah.
But I haven't given a whole lot of thought to how much social memory goes into creating an entirely fictional world. I guess if I was going to start, I would start by, you know, finding the elements of Martin's world that are pretty common in the modern imagination about the medieval world, which is something that I know you've probably done a lot more work on than I have.
Yeah. And of course others much more than me. But that's some of what we talked about already today, which pieces of the medieval world go, you know, get pulled forward by someone who has a cultural project,
right,
in Boston when they're trying to say, this isn't a city for the Irish. It's
yeah,
a city
I think
for...
like, let's go back to the animal thing again. So I think that Martin's going into this story thinking, well, all of my readers will know what a werewolf is.
Right.
You know, there's no one reading this book who's never heard of a werewolf. And so if I do a little something, if I flick my wrist a little bit, you know, they think that they know what a werewolf is. No. I'm going to throw them a curveball and they're going to see werewolves differently, because here we have this merger of man and wolf, but not in a way we've really seen before in these werewolf stories. And because he can assume that we all know what a werewolf is, he can subvert it in such a way that delights us. Like, ooh, I've never thought about it that way before.
Yeah.
So I think in many ways, Martin is drawing on collective memories with the intention of subverting them to create something new.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you've talked in many of your conversations with other guests about the chapters as you march through the book, about the kinds of other texts that he's citing. You know, he as a horror writer, is he engaging Stephen King over here?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
As a fantasy writer, is he engaging Tolkien over here? You know, like, which audience is he speaking to? You know, is he thinking about, like you said, someone who knows Tolkien and Stephen King when he's writing?
Sure. And I wonder how much of that, I mean, there are certain parts of that that are conscious, right? So there's a certain,
right,
there's a certain,
yeah,
part,
yeah,
of your memory that is a conscious memory. Like I loved, you know, I love this part of what King did. And then there are just elements of sort of the collective memory of your society that have seeped into you and made you who you are, you know, informed your identity.
Yeah.
And so you can't help but put those down on the page. So, for instance, with Tolkien, you know, how Catholic are these books? You know, he doesn't ever talk about Catholicism in the world, but there's so much of his sort of the mythology he's borrowed from the world of Catholicism that's seeped into his pores, that are part of his identity because of the collective memory of Catholicism, that it's almost impossible for him not to incorporate some of those mythic elements in the world that he's building.
Yeah, I have a friend right now who's teaching a class called Tolkien and the Catholic Imagination.
Oh, there you go. I mean, that's
yeah,
exactly. And so to a certain extent, Tolkien's conscious of this because, you know, he's using words like eucatastrophe, which,
right,
you know, putting
right
together the word for good and the word for catastrophic, you know, to kind of create a word that sounds like Eucharist and kind of sounds like catastrophe, which is a brilliant element of his work. And so he's conscious of that. But then there's lots of other little things about sort of, I know, sin and darkness and salvation that
coming back to life.
Is
he
really
die,
aware that,
if you're Gandalf,
that he's doing that? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's a good question. you know, World War One is going to be so much a part of who he was after he experienced World War One close up, whereas Martin probably experienced Vietnam on the television screen. And right. Those kinds of cultural touch points are going to be much different for those two authors. But something as cataclysmic as a world war is going to have all kinds of consequences in individual lives all over the world. And mm-hmm. so, of course, whatever the author is bringing to their own story, it's going to in some way have to deal with those anxieties, whether it's conscious or unconscious.
Yeah. And so I wonder, when we're thinking about like political scheming, empire building, attempts to hold on to and gain power, is there any Iran-Contra in Martin's world? You know, like,
it's so interesting.
I would love to.
Well, there's certainly,
I would love to see someone write about
it. I mean,
that. Yeah. Yeah.
You know, you've got these schemers behind the scenes. And that's really where Martin can have the most creativity. You know, for instance, what does Shakespeare not tell us about King Richard? Because
right.
the stuff yeah. that Shakespeare hasn't explored already, Martin is totally going to want to explore, right?
Yeah.
He's going to want to sort of, you know, use his paintbrush to fill up the negative space.
Hmm. Well said.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Ask Aaron anything!
Aaron, I am excited about Foundation, and my guess is you are too, because you're actually going to be covering this show.
Oh, yes. Yeah, it starts actually, by the time this podcast released, the three episodes will be out in the wild over there on Apple TV.
Nice.
We should be well on our way to figuring out what the hell's going on in this Foundation business.
Okay, so for people who are not familiar with the Asimov classic, can we call it a classic?
Oh, it's for sure a classic.
Okay, if people are not familiar with this classic work of science fiction, can you kind of give us the elevator pitch for this project?
Sure. In the far future of mankind, as humanity spans the entire Milky Way galaxy, a galactic empire, one man, Harry Seldon, discovers a branch of mathematics and psychology that he calls psychohistory that unerringly allows him to predict mass behavior amongst humans. And on a galactic scale, the mass adds up so much that he concludes that the galaxy, even though everything looks fine at the moment, is about to plunge into civil war and darkness, a dark age that's going to last 30,000 years.
Yeah,
and
it's not pitch, good. It's not a great situation.
It's not good. And his pitch to the powers that be are, if you trust in my plan to set up this foundation, which is going to be a repository for the sum total of human knowledge, we can cut that time down. There's no way to avoid it. It's going to happen.
Yeah.
But we can shorten that 30,000 years to but 1,000 years and shorten that human misery. Not eliminate it, but shorten it. If only you listen to my plan. Obviously, this is a story that has some resonance today with people, you know, being asked to do short-term you know, maybe inconveniences or giving up some individual liberty versus like the collective action and collective good. So there's a lot of good themes. You mentioned about this being a classic. This is highly influential. I mentioned Galactic Empire.
Yeah.
This is the first science fiction novel that postulated such an idea. If you didn't have Foundation, you wouldn't have Dune. In fact, Frank Herbert wrote Dune as a counterpoint to Foundation. You wouldn't have Star Wars.
Oh, I didn't know that. Is that?
Yeah.
All right. So
that's the extreme of the other way. Like what one individual can do to a whole galactic empire and turn it up on its head. So like it's kind of like looking at it through the other side of the lens. And I don't want to, because it's been a minute since I've read these books. I read these books in junior high and high school, and I haven't read any of the prequels or sequels. It's just the three mainline sequence.
So I just reread the first Foundation book.
Awesome. Jim did too.
And, you know, it was a long time since I had picked that up.
Right.
You know, it reads like one of these awesome sort of classic 1950s. It was 1950s, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 1950s science fictions. And I was listening through it and I was thinking, man, how are they going to do that? How are they going to adapt this? This is such a huge, you know, multi-generational plot that
it really is.
I was almost thinking like, boy, I hope they really butcher this, like butcher in a good sense. Like, I really hope that they take a lot of artistic freedom with this plot, because I think that may be the only way to make the adaptation work.
Yeah. So like, you know, there's a lot of commonalities between Foundation and the Game of Thrones, A Song of Ice and Fire series. Martin famously took a lot of his inspiration from the real life War of the Roses.
Yeah, and this is Roman Empire stuff.
Yeah, this was all inspired by Asimov reading Edward Gibbon's history of the decline and fall of the Roman Empire, and like, what if we do this in science fiction? Obviously, Rome was not built in a day. Did not fall in a day. No. So how do you tell that story? And that's one of the big challenges. How do you tell a story that has flash forwards of 50 years, 200 years, 500 years with a consistent set of characters? One of the common criticisms of the Foundation series is it's a pretty cerebral experience. You know, the characters are not as well developed maybe as you would expect from a modern science fiction novel.
Right.
And I think that's where the showrunners have some real opportunities to shine. That, like, you can, you know, keep, of course, the plot that's, I think, fascinating.
Yeah.
And just kind of, like, develop the characters. And, you know, the other thing is, like, these Foundation books are novella length. So you could probably reasonably do the Hobbit version of this, where each movie is 3 hours long.
That's true.
Puffing this out I think they're planning on this being 7 to 8 seasons of 8 or 10 episodes each, so about 70-80 hours of television. You really can take your time and develop this stuff.
That's interesting. I hadn't thought. No, actually, that makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
Now, so this is no real spoiler here, but I'm imagining our astute listeners would be smart enough to know that if it's written in the 1950s, there's a lot of technological advances in our world that haven't happened yet.
This is true.
So clearly there's a lot of optimism about what something like psychology can do on a mass scale.
It's kind of like what was it, Edward Nash's Beautiful Mind, like his Nash equilibrium and the economic theories of like competition and trade, like writ large. Like, what if you could keep doing that?
Even more recent is the most recent season of Westworld.
Sure. Yeah.
You know, you've got this big prediction machine happening, right? So I guess I'm kind of thinking, like, how are they going to make this seem like a plausible future with a 2021 imagination context?
It's a good question, because there's a lot of things, like you said, you know, cloning, like that was not a thing in the 50s. There's no concept of clones, although it does appear in that they're messing with cloning in the Imperial family. Mm-hmm. Just judging by some stuff we've seen in the trailers, there weren't interconnected network of computers. Computers are very infancy.
Yeah, Wikipedia did not exist yet.
Sure. Asimov, famous for creating the rules of robotics, this is pre him thinking about robots. So there's not even robots, at least in the main trilogy of the series. So it's going to be interesting to see what they kind of like update, because like I think that, yeah, with the stuff that people have been, the work that's been done on devs, the work that's been done on, as you mentioned, Westworld, these concept of like, you know, what is free will versus what is determination. Like, I think the modern audiences are prime for this kind of content, and it's like, it's going to be familiar concepts. Like, these were like cutting edge in Asimov's days, but it's stuff that we've kind of like, kind of worked on the last 75 years or so. And I
so
think
it's interesting to me. Yeah, right. I was just going to say, it's interesting to people like you and me who, like, we might like the archaeological experience of seeing what kind of imagination was required to make something like Star Wars possible or something like Dune possible. Right. But for, like, casual watchers who are just sort of in for a cool ride, is this the kind of thing that sort of the casual sci-fi fan should be interested in?
It's a good question, because the guy who's the showrunner, I can't remember his name, and his last name's Goyez. He is primarily known for a couple things. He wrote all of the Christopher Nolan Batman.
Oh, that's
good. Those. He also wrote all of the Zack Snyder Superman and Batman stuff. But he also, in the late 90s, he wrote a little gem called Dark City. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
So he's really good at kind of like, you know, he spans a bunch of different genres. If you've seen the trailers, like, this is some science fiction that, like, we really haven't seen before. This is like big planetary scale, galactic scale civilizations, even looks like there's warfare and stuff depicted. Like, it's going to be a visual treat. Like, this really leans into, you know, any kind of technology sufficiently advanced is going to resemble magic. There is almost like a high fantasy element from the trailers of, you know, what this technology can do. And I'm excited just for the visuals of it. And also, you know, to really hook you in, there is one of Bald Move's favorite performers in the last 5 years, Jared Harris. His first time on Mad Men as Lane Price. He was amazing.
Right, Chernobyl.
Saw him as Captain Crozier. Or was it Captain Crozier on The Terror and on AMC, which was amazing. And as you said, was this head Soviet nuclear physicist that kind of blew the whole lid open on the Chernobyl thing on HBO Chernobyl. This guy is so rock solid. He's great as a Belter separatist on The Expanse. Right. I love everything this guy does, and he is going to be the psychohistorian Harry Seldon. And his counterpoint, Lee Pace. I've liked Lee Pace in a lot of stuff he's done. I first noticed him on Pushing Daisies. You know, he was Ronan the Accuser in the first Guardians of the Galaxy. He was most recently in Bald Move, under a Bald Move radar, playing kind of a Steve Jobs pastiche on Halt and Catch Fire. He's really, really magnetic, and he's playing the Emperor of the Galaxy. So you've got, like, these two great lead actors and then an ensemble cast of a lot of, like, up-and-comers. It reminds me a lot of, like, you know, Game of Thrones. I don't know if this is going to be as big a Game of Thrones, but, like, you know, who the hell knew who Kit Harington was?
Sure.
You know, before, like, there's a bunch of young, unknown, but talented people that are cast in key positions. And I'm just really excited because, like, I feel like with this and Dune coming out within months of each other, within a month of each other, like, we are seeing kind of like this resurgence of, like, really hard, high concept science fiction in a way that, like, you know, maybe like, science fiction is going to start getting its due the way fantasy kind of started getting its due with Lord of the Rings, with Game of Thrones, all that kind of stuff. So, like, I'm just really excited that, like, 10 years ago, like, was Battlestar still on? Like, and that's pretty pulpy. But yeah, now we've got an embarrassment of riches.
I think Battlestar was like 20 years ago.
That's what I'm saying. Like, 10, like, we had like a dearth. There was Star Trek was dead. Star Wars is kind of like, wasn't it? Like, it hadn't, the new stuff hasn't been that great, in my opinion. But like now we've got embarrassment of riches. We've got everything from The Expanse. We got Foundation. We got Dune coming out. There's new Star Treks. There's a bunch of Star Wars series coming out that are kind of interesting and niche-y. We have just like us sci-fi fans just have a fucking smorgasbord ahead of us. And I hope these all succeed, because the other thing is if everyone hates it, like this is weird and nerdy, we don't like it, then it might be 30 years before we get something like this again. But man, I'm excited.
So the other thing that it bodes well for it is that it's an Apple TV thing. And I don't know about you, but I have not been disappointed with much of anything that's been on Apple TV. I could probably name like 7 shows that I've really enjoyed. And so if anyone's sort of like on the fence of whether actually, you know, pay the, what is it, $4.99 a month or something.
Or burn your 7-day trial or whatever it is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's been, I've been really impressed with what they've put together.
It went, in the last 2 years, Apple TV went from LOL, who and what, to like winning Emmy. Like, Ted, you got speaking of great science fiction, For All Mankind, wonderful.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, Ted Lasso's wonderful.
Morning Show just started a new season.
What's that one that's about the video game developers that that's got the guy from Always Sunny on?
Vision Quest, no,
something like that,
something Quest,
Dragon Quest, Treasure Quest. Yes.
So let's just assume that a lot of the listeners to this podcast will probably want to check out Foundation just because you and Jim are covering it. So I want to ask kind of a meta question about Bald Move.
Okay.
So like we said, there's a lot out there that's worthy of coverage. How do you guys decide what to cover and what not to cover?
Well, it's tough, and Foundation is one of the things that we're kind of really kind of taking a leap of faith on, because there's a 3-step process. Like, what do we think of it? Because if we're excited, like, you know, that we did, we jumped in on The Leftovers because of the weird Doomsday cult. And like, we grew up in a weird Doomsday cult. So we're like, and it's Damon Lindelof, even if this sucks, it's going to be worth kind of like talking about.
Mm-hmm.
We also kind of look and see like, you know, what is its pedigree? You know, like, is it based on a well-regarded novel? Does it have a whole bunch of actors that we've heard of? Is the showrunner somebody we're familiar with? And then the other one is like kind of like popularity. Like, if you start poking around, is there communities already around? You know, if we go and you know, there's a subreddit for a show that has 1,500 people on it. Whereas if you got something that's got 400,000 people, then it's a little bit more of a sure thing. This is a bit of a leap in faith because it is a weird show. It is on a show that's on a network that not a lot of people have. Although I guess if you have a modern Apple product, and a lot of people do, I think you actually have a free subscription to Apple TV, at least a year of it. It was the strength of the trailer, because I'd read these books as a kid. And I'm like, fucking Foundation and Jared Harris. Jim was already half in the door with Jared Harris, and then the first couple trailers dropped, and he's like, "Yeah, we should definitely." The question was, are we going to be talking this on OTC or off the clock, or kind of like our warehouse for stuff we're not doing mainline podcast, or are we going to do it like as a full on standalone show? And that's we kind of went all in, and we're doing it. It's Foundation and Podcast is the show. It's also going to be on Bald Move Pulp if you're subscribed to that too. But like, we're excited, and it's risky because like, we also feel like there's almost no risk to us waiting to see if season one is good. We can jump in at season two and start coverage, and we have a big enough audience that we usually can kind of like divert people over there. We don't feel like we're so excited about this one. We're kind of going all in, and it's been a while since we've had like kind of first run good science fiction. It's been like since the last year of The Expanse, so we're kind of jonesing for it too. That's kind of what all goes in.
All right, so by the time people hear this, you will have covered probably the first 3 episodes in one single podcast. Is that the idea?
I think the first podcast will do kind of like a thematic, discussions, not blow by blow, because then it'd be a 4-hour podcast. But then each week on the individual ones, it'll be the full recap, scene by scene. analysis, feedback, all that kind of stuff. So the first show will be, you know, since there's so much to talk about, it doesn't make sense to just talk about this episode, and because what people are going to watch them as kind of like one unit over the course of the weekend, and we're going to cover it as such. But then when the show slows down, we will also slow down and take it scene by scene, character by character, like we usually do.
I cannot wait. I love it. I love knowing not only that it's that there's a decent show on the horizon, but there's going to be a really fun sort of supplemental Bald Move coverage so that I can listen to something in the car or at the gym or whatever. That's always the best way to experience a new show like that.
Yeah, I agree. And I'm, you know, usually covering a show enhances my enjoyment if it's good. You know, hearing all the feedback from the community and all the different perspectives and stuff. And I'm really excited to be covering. I hope it's successful, but even if it's not, like, I think it's going to be 100% fulfilling to cover.
All right, man. So yeah, everyone, check out Bald Move Pulp. Look for Foundation and
Foundation and Podcast if you want to sub to the individual feed. Nice. If you don't want to get into all the
That's the title of your podcast. It's Foundation and Podcast.
Yeah, we're kind of like, you know, the later Foundation and Earth, Foundation and Empire. Yeah, Foundation and Podcast.
Nice. Very good. Very good. All right, man. Great to talk.
Yeah, talk soon.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off badass season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
For this week's Bird's Eye View, I want to talk about the shape of character-driven stories. Famously, Kurt Vonnegut Jr. said that every story is about a, and I quote here, man-in-hole problem. By this, he meant that every key character must fall into trouble, and the plot follows the character trying to get out of said trouble. Vonnegut was being intentionally glib to make a point, but the essence of the point is true. Stories have trouble in the middle, and the trouble is integral. So, because we are at the exact midpoint of A Game of Thrones, I want to talk a little bit about the POV characters. The prologue notwithstanding, there are 8 POV characters. This, of course, excludes characters like Robert and Littlefinger. interesting characters, but we will stick to our point of view, folks. In order of point of view appearance, these are Bran, Catelyn, Daenerys, Eddard, Jon, Arya, Tyrion, and Sansa. So, in order, Bran Stark. In our Gods of Thrones book, Aaron and I argue that Bran's story arc fits with the classic hero's journey. It has a literal fall from his familiar life, a supernatural guide, a call to adventure, and thus Bran is on his way to the pit. But, of course, Barton plans a much longer story arc for Bran, extending well beyond this book. So Bran's pit just gets deeper by the end of this novel. But at the midpoint of this novel, Bran's key problem is managing a new and strange way of living that falls far below his initial aspirations. He planned to be a knight, and now his body will not cooperate with that dream. Next, Catelyn Stark, Nee Tully. Kat's problem began at her doorstep and coaxed her back into southern politics. She knows that her family is in danger, but does not know why. Worse still, she is acting boldly on incomplete evidence and misinformation. At the midpoint, Kat has stoked the fires of war and has nothing to show for it. Littlefinger, Tyrion, Lysa, and Bronn have not cooperated, and now she is empty-handed and standing on the cusp of chaos. Next, Daenerys Targaryen. Dany is one of two characters on this list who is on the rise. She has trouble, but she began in such a deep pit to begin with that her empowerment functions as ascent. Her continued troubles include her ousted and insecure brother, and of course, Jorah's subterfuge. Next, Eddard Stark. Ned's trouble is that he thinks he's in a detective novel, when in fact he's in a horror story. King's Landing is his haunted house. He's like the bold and reckless guy who walks into the haunted house determined not to believe in ghosts. At this point, his troubles include his growing rift with Robert, his rivalry with Cersei, and his misplaced reliance on Littlefinger. Oh, and let's not forget that Kat has made a couple decisions of late that will complicate his life. Next, Jon Snow. Jon, like Dany, began at a low point. His life was going nowhere, and his home life was uncomfortable, a la Cinderella, Wart from Sword of the Stone, or Harry Potter. The Wall, in many ways, is worse, but he's finally enjoying the benefits of having true friendships. So Jon, like Dany, is on the ascent. That said, where the hell is Ben, Jen? Next, Arya Stark is in many ways adjacent to the rest of the story. In this way, she's like Dany, but she has experienced as much loss as any character in the story. She's been forced from her home. She's learning that her agency is limited due to social and family pressures. And her best friend was unjustly murdered, and she's the only one who cares about it. Now, here at the midpoint, she is worried for her father's safety, rightly so, and might need to say goodbye to her new dancing master. And I will say that even though she's experienced as much loss as anyone in the story, she's absolutely going to end this story with more loss. Next, Tyrion Lannister. Tyrion is in some ways very privileged and in other ways tragic. His encounter with Kat has left him imprisoned and without his usual recourse for social mobility. At the book's midpoint, he has nothing but his mind and the rumors of his wealth to save him from the Moondor. Finally, Sansa Stark. Sansa and Ned are on parallel trajectories. A Game of Thrones isn't kind to either. Both begin with privilege and comfort, and then spiral deeper and deeper, with very little hope of redemption. By the end of this novel, it is debatable which character ends up with the worst fate. The key difference, of course, is that Sansa's story will extend far beyond this first book. At the midpoint, Sansa's trouble is Joffrey's rotten heart and her father's incompetence. She thinks that her worst outcome would be to return to Winterfell and live in obscurity. She is wrong. Now, on this podcast, my guests and I have talked lots and lots about what makes this book a masterpiece. Let's add one more accolade to the pile. George Martin is using the old man-in-hole pattern, but he's giving us at least six different versions of it and intertwining them so that one plays upon the other. Finally, Ned is the only POV character whose plot intersects with all of the others. Ned's agency is even felt beyond the narrow sea in the lives of Dany and Jorah. His thread is the most integral to this first book. And of course, we know what will happen to Ned, and how his outcome will have the maximal impact for the overall story. It's genius. And that is all for you.